Hi, Kelvin.
Hi, Ode. Hi.
You're doing this wonderful work on Tetrionics, and you've done this amazing website with these very graphic pictures of your understanding, which all came out of looking at equilateral triangles, and from playing with that, as any child can do, come to the understanding how from the quantum level upwards, basically all of the universe falls in place as a kind of puzzle. And you've explained quite a number of topics about it already, and I really like that because it is definitely a learning curve of going away from the model which was created, of course, because people tried to understand matter, and then they needed to understand what molecules were, and then they needed to come to a grasp of these invisible atoms. And you've gone to the even deeper level and show that when you start with the Planck unit, basically from there on you can see how everything falls in place.
For sure.
We already spoke about the different kind of thinking that is needed for example, photons. You already spoke about atoms and how atoms can be seen to be based on complexes of deuterium. Not helium, but that you'd actually need a kind of gyroscope in the middle of it for the understanding of what atoms are and why they are and how they are, and you even have a whole understanding of how that works in capturing consciousness in life. But today I'd like to ask you something about basically the further step of what we already talked about. When I asked you how in Tetrionics the atoms work and how in Tetrionics radioactivity works, and at that point I got this understanding that I need to totally review my whole understanding of the atoms. My traditional the story that I had heard from the pulpit was that there are a kind of mini star systems with planets whizzing around at the speed of light, and that from that story I understood that there is something wrong in that model, because of course how can a photon going at light speed hit an electron going at light speed in just the precise manner so that it will actually pop from one level to another. And also, well, I can understand that there is a kind of logic where atoms would be hovering around at one wave band length, and that the next orbit out would be at a different wavelength band. And then in that approach you could easily say that at the wavelength of say one, the atomic will catch their own tails and they will have a standing wave at that level, so you can actually find it. And at the wavelength
Brawley waves.
Exactly. And the next level out, it will be the wavelength 2, so you'll have a standing wave there. And I can understand that right in between the two, you will have a plus and a half or a minus and a half. The waves cancel out, so of course you will not find electrons there. But then for me, if I look at it as wave bands and orbits, then I don't even need particles, because I will just have a standing wave and a wave node at the wavelength 1, and I'll have a standing wave at wavelength 2. I don't need particles for that. I will just have wave bands, which is much more simple, much more logical, much more understandable. So I realized that I needed total rethinking, because once you started to talk about the tetrionic view of the atom, basically everything was totally different. What you talked about was essentially a set of gyroscope working together like a solid state hard disk. You mentioned something that the whole notion about the jumping electrons was out of place. You mentioned about the way the energies moving in and out between those atomic complexes is different than the simple models describe. You already alluded to the way around every of these units there is a wave, like there is this ship trailing a wave around it. and that they need to be understood separately. You even went so far to explain that in the biology, surrounding electromagnetic field and the electrostatic field are actually more intensified and can be, let's call it, the signal wave around the carrier wave. So I would like to ask you to help me come to this other understanding that you came up with in seeing how from the triangles grouped as tetrahedra forming the fermions and the atoms, that everything is different from what I thought. And just as a kind of scaffolding, basically, if you could use that to help me build a bridge from the one end to the other end, I would like it if you could connect up to this old understanding which I had, which I already said, well, okay, at the one level, which would be the starting point perhaps, would be, okay, there's a wavelength, and then the wavelength has a length 1 and length 2 and length 3 and so on. So that would be a simple interference pattern of waves, which connects to the de Broglie description of interference fields, which essentially describes the same for the planets and for the atoms and for the molecules.
Yeah.
But then you already said, and that would be the third level of the question, in tetrionics, the right spin and the left spin are just the opposite part of the same dime. And in tetrionics, the electronics is right from the start included in the whole description. And that immediately carries on in the biology. In the I call that biologics. And the fourth part of my bridge or scaffolding, I hope you could help me on translating from the notion of magnetic and electric vortexing to tetrionics, because I know that a vortex is the dynamic equivalent of a tetrahedron. A vortex is a volume which from a surface through a streamline goes to a point. A tetrahedron is a volume which composed of planes formed by lines connects points, so that basically I can go from the notions that I was taught to where you are with tetrionics.
Right. That's a big chunk. I'll try and get it through and I'll try and clearly enunciate the thought processes, but there'll be some jumps along the way that if I'm jumping too far and you're not quite following, yell out, because we're going to cover a lot of ground just in those four topics.
Yeah, essentially it's from this planetary model of the books to the tetrionic model, which to me sounded like a more solid state kind of construct.
It is. It's more of a Lego block construction. I'll dive into it, and it's probably the best way to go. It's just to dive in, boots and all. I'll shoot you a few illustrations as we go along.
Great.
But I'll talk you through it, and hopefully everyone else can follow along. A little bit easier from my side, obviously, because my background in electrical engineering allowed me to become familiar with some basic electrical devices such as rotating converters and things like that. But these are all devices that you can look up on the internet and you can find them. They've been around since Tesla. Tesla invented them. Westinghouse used them, as did Edison. And they're still to be found around the place. You can still find textbooks on it in electrical theory, how they work. They've fallen out of favor purely because we've gone to a more solid state construction in most of our devices, whereas we used to use rotating converters, now we use solid state rectifiers, things like that, and we switch the current as it's flowing rather than storing it for use later on. But a rotating converter, and the reason why I bring this up is that a deuterium atom, in essence, when you build it using charged Planck quanta, the proton and the neutron have identical topologies but different charges. And the way that the quarks, three quarks in each of these, of the proton and neutron, which are baryons, form the up, down, up, and down, up, down, the way they form to make the protons and neutrons allows them to come together. So even though a neutron has neutral net charge, once it's formed, it's still made up of positive and negative equilateral charge fascia. And it coincidentally has exactly the opposite charge fascia of a proton, which is a plus one, the opposite of an electron. When you get to build these models from my theory using the templates, I just encourage you to sit there for a day and really look at these models and absorb the fact that using equilateral Planck quanta, we end up with protons and neutrons of a shape that is perfect for them to bond to each other and come together, despite the fact that the neutron is neutral. It's still one of the puzzles that modern physics just glosses over. How do protons attract neutrons in order to bind? How do these neutral particles stay in place? QED just says there's a residual strong force that brings it all about magically, and they just bind. It's shown in tetrionics that they come together because they do have opposite charge fascia. The positive charges of the proton line up with the negative charges of the quarks in the neutron, and vice versa. Their positives in the neutron attract the negatives in the proton and brings it all together. In amongst this, of course, is the Humble electron, which is a 12 pi lepton geometry, but its geometry is exactly like a three-pole rotor that you would find in these devices called synchronous rotors, or synchronous converters, more precisely. What a synchronous converter does, it is just a huge flywheel. Everybody's probably familiar with the idea of storing energy in a flywheel. Well, you can do the same thing with electrical energy. In the case of a rotating converter, as you apply energy to it, it stores the energy by spinning the rotor faster and faster. So the flywheel, and that's where you'll see all the pictures in the textbooks and on the internet of rotating, synchronous rotating converters, you'll see a huge flywheel. The electron has that shape. And in fact, you'll see in my work that the electron topology is very similar to the original design that Tesla had for rotating converters, three phase, etc. So at the quantum level, you have these blocks, not these, modern theory has it as two round balls with an electron rotating around the outside in the orbit like a mini solar system. In tetrionics, we have a solid state device. If you like, you can swap the proton for a north pole and the neutron for a south pole and have the electron rotating in the middle, storing energy. And that's in essence what it does. The proton and neutron store mass energy. Photons come in and heat them up or add energy to them. That in turn causes the electron to rotate at a certain speed. So what we have is these little blocks instead of round spheres with satellites orbiting. In the case of electrons, we have these little blocks of engineered structures, and that's the best way to describe them in my mind. Mm-hmm. You look at them and you just say that's something that has been built by human hands. And this is exactly what a deuterium atom looks like. It has a proton and a neutron and a rotating electron sitting in it. Now, these electrons have their own field. It's a chem field. As energy is added to the electron, it stores energy in the chem field, and that creates the motion, the motion of electrons. So if you want to accelerate an electron in a straight line, you add energy to it. You apply a voltage. That gets stored in the chem field. The square root of that chem field, which is the linear momentum, points in one direction and one direction only. and that's the direction the electron will move depending on how much energy is in that chem field. Now, as you add energy to that chem field, you're also in line with the equilateral geometry of the chem fields and tetraionic theory, you also create a proportional magnetic dipole, a north and a south pole, which didn't exist when the electron's standing still. It's only when you have these energies of motion that suddenly the electron will start to move and you'll have this magnetic dipole. It's commonly referred to as the Bohr magneton, or the Bohr magnetic moment of the electron, and it only appears when the electron's in motion, i.e. when it has energy in the chem field. This is what relativity was developed by Einstein to explain why stationary charges like electrons have no magnetic moment, but when they're moving they have a magnetic moment. There was no explanation as to where it comes about. What relativity theory says is that as the electron starts to move, or any object starts to move, it gets contracted slightly. The wavelength, which is called the Lorentz contraction, the wavelength of the energy changes slightly in proportion to the velocity. That's incorrect, and it stems from an incorrect understanding of what matter is versus what mass is. In tetraionics, we define mass as a planar, like a sheet of mass energy. It has no third dimension, it's just x and y components or coordinates, vector fields. Matter has a z component, so it has a volume, it has a shape, a topology, if you like. That's what I classically describe it as. I normally say a mass energy geometry, as in a flat sheet, versus a matter topology, as in a volume or a shape. And you'll see that throughout the work. But what happens is, because it wasn't properly defined as the differentiator between mass and matter, Einstein took the Lorentz contraction and applied it to all the energy of the system, because he dealt with mass and energies being equivalent and never defined matter. So he just said matter is made up of mass, so it's got to be all the same. In fact, you have a topology versus a geometry. When you accelerate a particle, the Lorentz contraction only applies to the chem field, the energy of motion, which is this equilateral field you'll see on all my diagrams that points in the vector direction of motion. It's a scalar equilateral field, and that equilateral field has linear momentum, it has kinetic energy, and it has the magnetic moment. That field only exists when you have energy to accelerate the electron or the particle. So without any energy of motion, you just have a stationary particle which has its charge geometry and its inherent elementary charge. That changes when you accelerate it or give it a push, F equals ma under Newton's formulations. You apply energy or a force to it. This chem field develops, and that gives it a linear, gives it energy of motion, which gives it a magnetic moment and a vector direction or a vector velocity. With that said, all you have to now do is imagine what happens if you have this electron that wants to move, but for one reason or another, you hold it in one place. By pinching the sides, for example, at the north and south poles, it can't move forward because you're applying this force to hold it in place. So what it does in turn was, the energy that would normally be moving it forward is turned into a rotational motion. The rotor geometry of the electron starts to spin. And you'll see in a lot of quantum mechanic books that the electron has a spin, which is associated to its magnetic moment, usually in terms of Planck bar, which is Planck divided by 2. If you divide a chem field by 2 pi, I should have said, by 2 pi, to give you Planck bar or Dirac's constant, you are actually measuring half of the chem field. So in this case, you would be not measuring the magnetic moment, but you'd be measuring the kinetic energy or the electric component, which is the diamond area, or half the area equal to the magnetic moment of that chem field itself. As I'm saying this, I'm realizing I should have sent you a few illustrations to go with this, so I'll look them up now. Just bear with me while I get the right one for you, and this will make a bit more sense.
Why are you doing that, Calvin? It would help me if you could somehow explain a bit about the starting point, which is the triangles and the tetrahedra and the complexes that come out of that. Because when you talk about the motions, in tetrionics there is this very fundamental concept that within a triangle there will be an inscribed and a circumscribed circle. In a tetrahedron, likewise, there will be inscribed and a circumscribed sphere. And so when you speak about the dynamic of the movement, at one level, the basis of tetrionics is in the triangles and the tetrahedra. So I'm trying to see, when you talk about movement, is that at the level of the circles and the spheres, or do I need to think about rotating triangles and rotating tetrahedron? It's a combination of both.
It's even simpler than that. You have your model of tetrahedra representing the vortex and things like that. In tetrionics, the tetrahedra is simply a quantum of matter. It's the smallest three-dimensional form of matter that energy, or mass, energy, momenta, can form. And you form that by folding up the four triangles, as we've mentioned before. To answer your question that you just posed then, if you go back to the very basics of tetrionics, you have an equilateral triangle of Planck energy, which has an electric and a magnetic component. Now, you can model that triangle with the electric and the magnetic fields and draw a circle inscribed inside the triangle. Now, it can rotate left or right, and in this case, that left or right is simply a indication of the charge. If you were to form a normal inductor, a coil of wire, charge it up and join the ends together, it would form a north and a south pole, just like that triangle. And the tails coming up to join above would form a triangle. And that would be your electric field forming the magnetic. And depending on which way you wind that coil, left or clockwise or counterclockwise winding, will change whether you get which position the north and the south field will be. That's why those circles are inscribed in the triangles. That they're not physically there. You may view them for people in physics trying to get a handle on what I'm trying to convey with tetrionics. You may view them alternatively as a flux, an indicator of the flux direction going from electric to magnetic, back to magnetic into electric, and whichever direction it goes, it creates a north-south or a south-north orientation of the dipole, which accordingly is either a positive or a negative charge. And again, you can have a positive on the opposite side of a negative if you look at the same arrangement from the opposite side. If you were to draw a triangle like the templates, and you could see both sides of the sheet, turning the sheet over and looking at it the other side physically is exactly the same, or is equivalent to what mathematically would be described as a Lorentz transformation, where you change your coordinate or your transformation of the coordinate system from one side of a system to another. Mathematically very complex, physically in tetrionics very simple. You flip the coin over. You flip the triangle over, you get a different charge. And accordingly, you can rotate the triangle so it points the other direction, in which case, instead of reversing the charge, rotating it 180 degrees, it keeps the same charge, but the vector of the linear momentum points in the opposite direction. And that's important because the rotation versus the flipping, and whether it changes or doesn't change the charge, brings up what's called chirality in physics, why we have left and right-handed particles and why we have opposite charges. It completely explains that from a very simple perspective of a triangle. So in tetrionics, I draw this loop to indicate that it can be viewed electrically as a inductive loop, which explains inertial mass as well as charge. You'll note that it only tends to be drawn in the quantum mechanics ebooks. After that, I tend to drop it out and don't use it a great deal because I assume that having read the QM books, you're familiar with it and you're doing it automatically in your head anyway. But that's that inscribed circle usually refers to inertial mass or charge more specifically. And when you have two opposite charges, they'll always seek to equalize. So if you've got billions and trillions and zillions and quadrillions and googlinions of these charges in a given space, they'll interact positive to negative and they'll build complex shapes. Now, some of these will be fields like bosons and photons, which are odd or even geometries that form. Or in some cases, you'll actually form these tetrahedra, which I call tetrions. They're an unknown particle at the moment. They exist in the experiments, but nobody knows to look for them the correct way, so they're mistaken for electrons and strange quarks and things like that. They have exactly the same charge ratios, so that they're hidden, if you like, in the debris of normal collisions and mistaken for those particles. But these tetrions, the tetrahedral geometries, are purely matter. There's no vortex inside them and nothing. The only thing that they have is this tetrahedral geometry and four charges that make up the tetrahedral shape. Now, they can be four negative or four positive or two positive and two negative to make a neutral particle. Again, neutral tetrions, I go into detail in my work, they're mistaken for gluons holding particles like baryons together, whereas gluons are traditionally seen as a field or something along those lines. They're shown to be in tetrionics to be a neutral tetrion. The interesting thing about the tetrions, once you have positive, negative, and neutral ones, is that there'll be for every positive and negative, there'll be two neutrals formed in a given mixture. And what happens is as these positive and negatives come together, they can either join directly, positive to negative, and form a particle, or in most cases, what'll happen is you'll have these neutral tetrions come between them, in which case the positive negative, the two positive, two negatives of the tetrion will bind with opposite charges. Either the positives will join of the tetrion will join with negatives of negative tetrions, and they'll form larger and larger particles. The first particles they form are the quarks, and three tetrions come together to form a quark, and their net charges will either be eight or four, plus or minus. So you have 12 charged fascia, three tetrions, because they have four charges each. So three tetrions come together to form a quark. Where the positive and negatives combine, they form a quark geometry, and it's quite distinct from the other geometries. I'll send you a picture of the quark geometry so that you have it. Yeah, I'll send you like one of the
classical crown shape.
No, it's more like a quark is a three-dimensional trapezoid, for lack of a better word. I would describe them in Platonic terms as a topology, as a octahedral. When the 12 charge fascia to come together, only eight are visible to us on the outside. Four of those charge fascia out of the 12 are hidden inside the final topology. And when you build the models, you'll see that's what happens, that they're a very unique topology and you can't mistake them for anything else. They're an odd-looking thing. But they're for all intents and purposes, they're best described as an octahedral. not the classical octahedral that you'll see drawn in textbooks from Greek topology. Completely different. The topology that Tetrionics creates, to my knowledge, up until my work, haven't been described in mathematics or geometry. Like the equilateral geometry itself, it's been relatively neglected. And definitely in the case of the quarks, electrons, and baryon topologies, I haven't been able to find those particular topologies in any textbook that I've looked through to date or searched for on the web. And I've searched long and hard because I was searching for names for these particular topologies. In the end, I used the Platonic topology names, hence octahedrals, eight. It just turns out that the charge also ends up being eight or four, plus or minus, for quarks. But where you have similar charges, i.e. three negative tetrahedrons, they can also bind together along their axes, along the dipoles, via the weak force. As in, if you imagine them binding along three coils, joining together to form an axis of the rotating converter that I spoke about earlier. When this happens, those 12 charged geometries don't form an octahedron. They actually form a dodecahedron, 12-sided topology. And that's quite distinct. I'll send you a picture of that. It is quite distinct from that of a quark. Even though they're both made up of 12 charged geometries, and they're for most parts identical so far as their constituent charge, Planck charges and things like that, their net charge is different. If you look at the plus 4 and plus 8 or minus 4 and minus 8 for quarks and compare it to the plus or minus 12 for electrons and positrons, which are just three negative tetrions and three positive tetrions coming together, you'll note that the four and the three are 1/3 and 2/3 of the electron's charge, because you've got this unique topology of the electron, and that fully accounts for the partial charges of quarks. That there's many books written on in QED and many explanations given as to what could be causing quarks to have this partial charge. It's normally written away as being an artifact because you've broken up a baryon, a proton or a neutron, and the quarks can't exist as a partial charge. So any of these partial charges will quickly recombine to form a plus one or a minus one. Tetrionics shows us that the plus one and minus one of protons and electrons isn't a plus one and minus one. It's in fact a plus 12 and a minus 12. Everything so far as charge is concerned in modern physics theory should be multiplied by 12 in essence. Many people have worked on different aspects along this, and there's a few theories floating around out there where they have in fact multiplied the elementary charge by 12 and said, hey, there's a pattern here, but they've never taken it to the extent of tetrionics to show the actual physical topology and to explain the mechanics like tetrionics does. That aside, what we've now done is we've built the quarks. We obviously have up and down quarks. We have anti-up and anti-down, which are the 4 and minus 4 and 8, minus 4 and minus 8 charges. We have electrons and positrons, which are minus 12 and plus 12 respectively. And we have one final particle that this creates, and that's where we have 12 opposite charges coming together. And when we have 12 opposite charges coming together, they form a neutral charge lepton. And you might have guessed it, the neutral charge lepton is in fact what we call neutrinos. They're just a neutral lepton. So they're smaller mass. And again, I won't go into detail here because it'll just drag on and on. But the leptons all have exactly the same size topology, same physical sizes. So electrons, positrons, and neutrinos are all identical-sized particles. Most people think of neutrinos as being really, really tiny, almost massless particles, as they're commonly termed. It's true that they have very little mass, but they have the same physical topology. And this is where tetrionics shines, because as you develop an understanding of tetrionics, you get a very clear understanding and differentiation between mass and matter. In using this as a clear example of neutrinos versus an electron, the neutrino would have 12 Planck charges making it up, just 12 quanta, all of positive or negatives, but equal amounts, so that it's got a neutral overall charge. Whereas in the case of the electron, it has 1 by 10 to the 20 Planck charges in 12 charged topologies. In other words, for each charged fascia of a neutrino, the electron has an identical charge fascia, but it has 1 by 10 to the 19 triangles of energy in that charge fascia. As the Planck charges are mass energy, obviously the electron has more quanta, therefore it has more mass than the neutrino, even though they are physically identical sizes. It's two topologies that are identical size-wise, but one has 12 quanta, the other one has 1 by 10 to the 20 quanta in it, and that makes it heavier. So you have more mass in the matter topology for an electron than you have for a neutrino. That's a key point, and it took me a while to get my head around it as well. Don't be thinking you're alone there, because it takes a while. By the way, that number, 1 by 10 to the 19, is commonly referred to as the Compton frequency. It's the number of quanta in a charged surface. It's often mistaken to be a resonant frequency or something like that for an electron. It's just a physical number of triangles in each charged fascia that make up the final topology. These are key points, because electrons, neutrinos, and positrons are all identical, save for their charge, and they can all bind to various deuterium nuclei, and their role is obviously the rotating converter in the synchronous. The rotating is the rotor component of the rotating converter. So when energy is added to an electron, to a baryon, or to a nuclei that the electron's bound to, it will make that electron spin faster while it's bound. And this is where the math and the modeling of modern physics is accurate, but the physical model is completely inaccurate. That the math can tell you how fast they should be moving and all the rest, but what's missing is they're applying it to a incorrect understanding of what quantized angular momentum is. In standard or modern physics these days, quantized angular momentum is a measure of spin. It's a nebulous term, a bit like energy. It just means that there's a motion that creates a magnetic moment, a Bohr magneton, as the electron moves. In tetrionics, the quantized angular momentum is actually a physical equilateral geometry, and that gives rise to this magnetic dipole due to motion, energies of motion. And if the electron is not bound to a nuclei, that electron and the energies in its chem field will cause a motion. It will have linear momentum, it will have a kinetic energy, and it will have a magnetic moment as it accelerates due to the force and the energies from that force in proportion to the mass, F equals ma. If, on the other hand, that electron, or the lepton, be it a neutron or a positron or electron, is held in one spot and the same force is applied, it has no choice but to rotate. And it will spin. And this is where the established terminology of spin and things like that goes horribly wrong. You'll see spin mentioned on Wikipedia and in textbooks as being a term that was put in to explain the magnetic moment of electrons in atoms, or as they're measured as they move along through the Stern-Gerlach experiment. They have a plus or a minus spin based on which direction their magnetic moment is, the vector of that's pointing. So they just gave it a plus or a minus value, and there was no understanding of what was causing it or anything like that, which is where Einstein came in with relativity, because he understood that there had to be an explanation for this, plus the motion of magnets and conductors with respect to each other, and how current is created, and how this magnetic moment itself comes about. He worked with his understanding, and let's remember that it's over a century ago that he was doing his work. He worked with the best of his knowledge, just as Newton did before him, and came to some conclusions which led him to relativity theory. Tetrionics has now come along, started with these triangles of energy, built the physical models of quarks and tetrions and electrons and baryons, and said, this is wrong. The magnetic moment is created by the energy in the chem field. The energy in the chem field, the more energy you try to pack into that triangle, the smaller those triangles become. They become compressed in that same geometry, so their wavelength contracts, but only the wavelength of the chem field, not the wavelength of the mass energy in the matter. It remains, as I term it, invariant to Lorentz contractions. It always remains the same. It's unchanging. What changes is the energy in that chem field. And whether the chem field, if the electron's bound, it will spin. If it's not bound, it will accelerate away from the point where the force was applied, where it was sitting stationary prior to the force being applied. And that's the basics of physics in the atom. The only other thing we have to do here is take those quarks with their 4 and 8 plus and minus charges and combine them. Because remember, second rule of tetrionics is that energy in all its forms seeks equilibrium. A plus and a minus charge doesn't like to be sitting around by itself. It will always seek out opposite charges to reach a neutral state. Hence why we have neutral matter and neutral particles. So the plus and minus 4 and 8s will immediately, in the case of quarks, start to bind together to seek equilibrium. They bind together in groups of 2 to form mesons and pions, kaon particles, which are a whole mixture of quarks, be they the same charges or dissimilar charges, or quarks and anti-quark components. They form first, and from them, the second level of interaction between the quarks brings about the baryons. I'll just give you the actual slide for that. And for those that are just listening along, is actually slide, or tetrionics illustration 9.03. It's called baryon formation. What happens is the quarks come together to form mesons, and then an extra quark, because the mesons still aren't at plus or minus 12 or neutral, so they're still seeking equilibrium. So a third quark will join, and that's where we have 3 quarks in a proton, or 3 quarks to form a neutron, or antiproton and antineutron as well. All 4 particles can form from quarks, along with the mesons and the pions, kaons. The whole family or subfamily of particles there can be formed from these quark combinations seeking equilibrium. What really gets confusing for most people is that having been taught and grown up on the idea, like I was, of protons being round spherical balls of charge, and these latest illustrations of quarks with three colors and lines between the quarks changing colors as they move along to form this spherical proton, suddenly that model's completely vanished. And what we have in its place is a unique geometry or topology of 36 charges forming the baryon family, which are the protons, neutrons, antiprotons, antineutrons, pluses, minuses, and neutrals. Again, energy in all its forms seeking equal states or equilibrium. So the three quarks don't form little round balls inside the spherical balls of the neutron or the proton. Instead, what they form are these, what I call icosahedral topologies. The 36 charges have 16 charged fascia hidden inside them when they form a baryon topology. So what you're left with is 20 charged fascias on the outside of the protons and neutrons. From the top, they look like a pentagon. From the underside, they look like a hexagon. It's just a unique geometry. It's when I first built them, I looked at them, and I was confused that I'd built some monstrosity. And everyone will feel the same way, because they're not the round spheres by any stretch of the imagination. The top has four sides that are clearly, or say six sides, with a V cut into it, looking from the top down. The bottom has five with a V cut into it. It's not until you build the models that you suddenly realize this. And the five versus six, as far as the edges of this topology, are very important, because they only allow protons and neutrons to come together one way. And that's what forms the deuterium nuclei. You have a proton and a neutron. Again, in the case of, just to elaborate, a proton with its and neutrons with their 36 charges will be formed in the following charge configurations. I'll just get them for you as we talk. Mm-hmm. Protons have 36 charged geometry, 24 of which are positive and 12 of which are negative. Now, this all comes from the quarks that go together, that go into building them. And you look back through the standard model and the QED models and the QM models, you'll see that everything lines up as per the standard modeling in place. What's changing is only the geometry that's in use. We're going from spherical geometries to these equilateral and tetrahedral geometries, topologies. So the 24 positive and 12 negative cancel each other out to give you plus 12, which is the exact opposite charge of the electron with its 12 negative charges, minus 12. So you have an electron with a rotor shape, three pole rotor, three tetrions, and you have a proton with nine tetrions in it, forming the exact having the exact opposite net charge of an electron, what we classically call minus one and plus one elementary charges, which in tetrionics terms is really minus 12 and plus 12 quantum charges, which is reflective of the geometry. To cap it off, the neutron, which has exactly the same topology as a proton, has 19 positive and 18 positive and 18 negative charges, which cancel each other exactly to give zero. So instead of, even though it's got an exactly the same shape as the proton, the quarks that make it up, down, up, down, give you a charge of zero, exactly as the standard model shows us and exactly as experiments show us. So despite this really strange building pattern using triangles of Planck quanta that are charged and having 12 versus 36 charges and having final geometries of 12 versus 20 in the topologies, we have equal but opposite charges on the electron and the proton that bring it together, and we have a charge arrangement in the proton and neutrons that is exactly opposite each other. Where you have an up quark, you have a down quark in the neutron. Where you have a down quark in the proton, you have a up quark in the neutron. So they're exact opposites, and what that causes is for the neutrons and protons to pull each other together to form this synchronous quantum rotator geometry. I'll just shoot you another file. You'll get a heap of files. I'll just send them through so that you've got them there for reference.
Thank you.
Taking these three quarks that are possible that we've mentioned before, you can mix them up. Again, just like the triangles before them that built them, you can have a whole box or a tin full of, or a room full of quark topologies, and they will seek each other out via their opposite charges and combine. What they combine is a whole mixture of particles that are baryons, and that creates what's called the particle zoo. When they first encountered all these strange particles being formed in the accelerator collisions, it's because they were smashing baryons together. The baryons were breaking up into their quarks by the three times however many quarks there are, plus whatever ones they created, and then they were recombining. And as they recombined via their opposite charge faces and the energy in the collision, they created these heavier, stranger forms of baryons, the particle zoo. And you'll see there in my illustration, in that illustration there, I think there's 216 possible combinations of quarks out of the four basic forms of quarks and the three generations due to the energy levels. So out of those 12 possible combinations, we end up 216, I think, from memory, possible combinations in the particle zoo, plus another 216 for their antiparticles. So in total, there's 512 possible particles in the particle zoo that can be fully accounted for using simple models, paper models made from tetrionic theory. All that's an aside. That's just how we build this deuterium nuclei. But that gives you the basics of building these nuclei. They operate, as I said, just as a synchronous rotating converter in the electrical fashion. They store energy and they release it. They store the energy by making the electron spin faster. You get to a point where the energy of the proton and neutron, the deuterium or deuteron nuclei, is such that the electron's got too much energy for the nuclei to hold onto it anymore. When it reaches that energy level, it breaks away, and that's the basics of the photoelectric effect. You add enough energy, the electron will spin faster and faster in its bound position. It's not orbiting about the nuclei, it's stuck in the nuclei. In fact, when you build the models, you'll see that the electron, basically half of the electron is buried inside a nuclei when it binds to it. It's physically inside the nuclei. As you add energy, it spins faster and faster until it gets such energy that it can break away. And when it does, it just accelerates in a straight line and it stops the spinning motion because all the energy goes into traveling in the straight line. Electrical engineers will be more than familiar with the rotating synchronous converter as an electrical device. People familiar with Tesla can relate all of Tesla and Westinghouse's, General Electric's work, Edison's work with rotating converters directly to the deuterium nuclei, not the hydrogen nuclei, the deuterium. You've got a proton and a neutron with an electron spinning in it. If the electron breaks away, by the way, it takes away the energy that it's of its acceleration, and you're left with just a deuterium nuclei that's got a plus 12 charge, which will attract another free electron to it. And once that electron binds to it to equalize the charges, whatever energy level the proton neutron are at will make that electron spin at that speed. Now here's the interesting part. As I've mentioned before, the chem fields are equilateral in shape. They're secondary fields. They don't exist until energy of motion or force is applied to the electron. And depending whether it's bound or not, depends whether the electron will accelerate or just spin as a result of that force. But it's an equilateral shape field. By definition, under tetrionics, you can only add squared number of quanta to an equilateral field. You can only add 1, 3, 9, 16, 25, 36 quanta to a chem field. You can't add 5 quanta. Now, if you extend that to the photoelectric effect and to Bohr's quantized fields, suddenly it becomes apparent that's the explanation between 4 quantum levels of energy to nuclei that are trapped or bound to the deuterium nuclei. They can only be in squared numbers because the energy is being added to the chem field, not to anything else. So the electron, when it's bound to a nuclei, can only accept energy levels that are, or quanta to make energy levels of 1, 4, 9, 16, or squares of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And it stops at 8, and that's another story altogether. When it reaches 9, or it goes from 16 and gets 65 quanta, say, which is more than 64, the electron will break away. Well, actually, when it's 82 quanta, 9 squared is break-free energy. There's 8 quantum levels that can be formed, and the 9th, or anything over the 8th, 64, 65, say, is enough energy to break free. QED, ebook of mine, goes into this in much more detail. But if you just work on these squared numbers, you can explain Rydberg's formula, which is basically the difference of two inverse squares. You can explain Bohr's radii, which are all squared number atomic jumps. You say you've got to go 1, 4, 9, 16. You can't go any numbers in between. They're all squared numbers or equilateral geometries. So that the quantum jumps are explained when the electron is bound. When the electron is unbound, you can add any amount of energy to that chem field. It'll just accelerate the electron a bit more because it's not fixed by the deuterium nuclei. So what we've now done in this time is we've built up a model of the atom that's completely different to standard models. We've used equilateral charges to explain the partial and plus one and minus one elementary charges of all the particles. We've explained the particle zoo, what quarks are and why they've got a partial charge, what their actual shape is, how they make baryons in groups of three. We've also explained the role of the electron and the mass difference between neutrons and electron-positron sets, which are the same matter topology, but differing amounts of quanta, therefore differing masses. And we've explained why the electron, when it's bound to a nuclei, only increases its only jumps in energy levels in square numbers, because the energy is only added to the chem field of the electron. of course, we've also explained things about relativity and where charge comes from and magnetic moments, etc., and differentiated between mass and matter, topology versus, well, geometry versus topology in the case of tetrionics. Now, in doing so, we've banished this idea of a mini solar system. We no longer have that. We have instead, instead of an electron rotating or circling, orbiting around a spherical proton or proton-neutron, we now have a three-pole rotor for an electron sitting inside a very unique rotating converter, an electrical design device, if ever there was, as drawn and used by Tesla and the rest, as I've mentioned. But we now have this design, so we can show clearly that the, from this perspective of charge and Planck quanta, that the universe is no longer this round, spherical, natural sort of model that we've grown up with. It's now a distinctly engineered design. It's as though God sat down at his workbench and said, "How do I make a universe?" And he started with a triangle of energy. Mm. And from there, the rest just flowed out, just as it's done in my work. You can use, by using the equilateral triangle and its opposite charge fascia, you can build everything that I've just described using the templates in my books and on the websites. You can print them out, cut them out, and make every single one of these models as I've done now. And then you can use the math from this geometry to describe all the processes of Bohr's radii. Just trying to find the picture here so I can send you that as well. And it relates directly back to the energy levels of the chem fields. Here it comes. For those that are just listening and looking in the books, it's illustration 1805, and it's titled Bohr Radius. And you can see there quite clearly that the energy level of the chem fields matches up with what you'll see in most textbooks as the Bohr radius. As the energy increases, the radius increases. Though, as I point out in that illustration, it's purely an illustrative idea, because obviously Bohr saw from the observations and then modeled his idea, whereas I'm building from the ground up, from the equilateral geometry. I'm building these geometries and topologies, and then I'm explaining the observations that exist. I'll send you another one, another two. This next one is principal quantum levels, which is the illustration before it. It will show you how when an electron, is, the same electron is bound to deuterium nuclei, it has fixed energy levels, and it actually gives you, I've written in the energy levels and the number of quanta in the chem field for each energy level. And if you go back to the textbooks and their math, you'll see that they all line up for the ionization energies, etc. So they're all identical. My theory matches the observations, and the observations match my theoretical models. So in that sense, it's a experimental proof of my work, although the experimental proof has existed for the last century. All I've done is given flesh and physical topologies and geometries to the models of the atoms and the particles themselves, along with their fields. You'll see in the last illustration I sent you, it simply shows you what happens to that the electron if it's not bound. It goes from a spin with a certain frequency of light and rotation speed to an acceleration, linear straight line motion. So again, the difference between the illustrations is if it's bound, it spins, but if it's unbound, that same amount of energy will make it accelerate in a particular direction. That's the essence of where the final part of this puzzle comes in, and that's the last illustration that I've just sent you. and it just simply shows you a very clear, it's marked 1801 photoelectron of chem fields in Tetrionics ebook, and in the illustrations on the web. It simply shows you an electron bound to a deuterium nuclei, and then it shows you the up and down spins, as they're termed in modern physics, as being simply the direction of motion, or direction of spin, physical spin, of the electron when it's bound. So, another confusing aspect, and I won't go into great detail because there's a number of illustrations in my work in chapter 18, 19 that go into it in great detail, but the magnetic moment, or vector magnetic, the Bohr magneton of the electron, when it's referenced to the nuclear magneton, which is just the magnetic dipole of the proton neutron or the deuterium nuclei in motion, it develops, has its own chem field and its own magnetic moment and linear momentum. When they move, they can be either the dipoles of the electron and the deuterium nuclei can either be in the same direction or they can be in opposite directions. Now, we now get into what's normally termed spin, electron spin in particular, and it's always referenced, whether it's up or down, with respect to the nuclear magnetic dipole that's created. So if the atom's in motion, and let's face it, most of them are, it will have its own magnetic moment, which is much weaker than the electrons, because the electrons are rotor design. It's far more efficient at creating a magnetic moment than the proton neutron or deuterium nuclei by itself is. It's much weaker. But if the north-south is in the same direction as the north-south of the dipole of the deuterium nuclei, it is then termed an upspin. That, if you like, two norths will repel, and that has more energy in it. It will tend to want to flip the direction. So that's what that illustration is showing you. You have an up or a down spin, which is related to the actual physical spin of the rotor of the electron in the deuterium nuclei with respect to the magnetic moment of the atom itself. All technical stuff, and if you're trying to just follow along without the illustrations, it will be very hard to comprehend exactly what I'm saying. Even with the illustrations, it can be difficult to work out whether it's an up or a down spin, because in essence, it's just a chem field with a magnetic moment. And electrons always have the same magnetic moment. The only thing that changes is the direction of motion, whether it's moving upwards or downwards, up or down spin. It was coincidentally given that name. Trying to explain it, just turns out to be happenstance that it actually does match, for the most part, what is physically happening at the quantum level. So serendipity strikes in this case. It's not always the case. It can be times where it just doesn't line up descriptively, but in this case it does, and that's what that last illustration shows. It shows you the chem field, it shows you the electron sitting in the middle, and in bound positions at the bottom. It shows it's an up or a down spin depending on the direction of motion of the deuterium nuclei, which is at the center of the bottom of that page. And it's how those directions relate to each other determines whether it's an up or down spin. It's not literally an up spin because it's pointing up on the page. It can in fact be a down spin if the deuterium nuclei is moving the other way. So as per normal, as good as Tetrionics is, it doesn't take away some of the complexity of the quantum systems. They still exist. It just makes explaining and understanding them a lot easier as you get used to it. Obviously, if you're coming across this discussion first up, it's going to sound a bit confusing without the illustrations, and until you get your head right around them. But that's the essence of the differences between the standard model of atoms and the tetrionic model or topologies of atoms, and how they work to give us, through the plus and minus charges, to give us these results that we observe and measure. But in all cases, a tetrion simply is a quantum of matter. There's one tetrion, then you have, they combine to give you a quark, which has three tetrions, or a lepton, which has three tetrions. Those three tetrions will keep combining to give you a whole variety of particles, but ultimately ending up at baryons, which are nine tetrions in a group, giving us plus and minus elementary charges and the basic physics of quantum mechanics. And it literally is mechanics, because as I've described it, the rotating synchronous converter is literally a electromechanical device. We can build one in full scale, and we have. It looks like God has done no differently. He simply designed the universe. And from that perspective, as we've talked in other discussions about smaller chem fields, making BEM fields, making consciousness and the human identity on a planet, planetary or even a galactic scale, with EM fields holding things together, just different scales of the same thing. Similarly, we have the same thing here. We have a quantum scale synchronous rotating converter which reacts to incoming lights or photons of light, or electromagnetic waves, which in turn spins the electron to excite it. Now it can store that energy as mass inside its matter topology, in which case it can then, with no light shining on it, release some of that energy over time. And it does that simply by releasing it into the chem field of the electron, making it spin a bit more, and we observe that as radioactivity, where the electrons are accelerated away because the atom's got too much energy. It gives you beta decay and things like that. All that's documented in the chemistry ebook, and I didn't go into it here because it's another discussion into itself. But all the things we observe and we've tried to explain with modern physics, and even the last 400 years of physics, the last 100 years in particular, are now, have just been described using an equilateral triangle of energy, a Planck, and building it up.
As I could say, I'm glad I asked.
Yeah, that's not the normal reaction I get. It's normally sit down and be quiet.
It's wonderful. I'm so much enjoying this, because I like it when my head actually can chew on something, and when it is actually turned on into a new understanding. And, of course, it takes a bit of practice and training, because in my research, I show that first we have freedom of choice, and then we make a decision, and then we have a belief, and then we have the reflex. So when I listen to you, I see the reflexes sort of bounce up and down, that I can sort of see the underlying belief systems of the ones who told me these stories, and that it now comes down to a decision of, okay, we looked at physics from a perspective of waves of water, because that's what Helmholtz and Hertz and all the guys were doing. But when you look at it from the perspective of tetrahedra and triangles, equilateral triangles, then suddenly everything needs to be rethought, a new decision needs to be taken. And I like that, because, of course, part of me is an engineer, and as an engineer, I always go for the simplest solution. That's also called Occam's razor. If you want to get a pocket knife, why not get the one which has all the tools built right into it? And in tetrionics, it's basically there's just the one tool and everything falls out of it. I love it.
It is absolutely mind-boggling. And I've said this to Rennie and others that I've had discussions with over time, and I'll probably continue until I cease to breathe. There are times when I just sit down and look at what I can create and explain using a simple triangle, and I'm just left stunned and amazed at what it can do, how we've missed it all this time. There have been literally hundreds of thousands of very bright people and people just thinking about all this that have completely missed it. And yet here it is, a simple triangle gives us everything we need to explain the physics of the entire universe. It creates every particle, every field, gives us all our forces of motion, and yet it starts with just a simple triangle. It just stuns me, even to this day. And what I love most is when I have moments of real reflection like that and contemplation, I then look at pictures of nature, landscapes and things like that, and waterfalls. And when you look at that and then think of it all as being made up of these little triangles, it is absolutely stunning. The complexity, the richness, the beauty that we get out of these triangles. And here's something that'll be worth another discussion at another time. Tetrionics shows that there is no indeterminacy at the quantum level. They like to talk about Heisenberg's uncertainty principle as a get out of jail card free for the mathematicians. Oh, we can't explain it because the momentum and the position can't be known at the same time. Tetrionics shows that you can, in fact, model the momentum and the position at all times, and that everything is not indeterminate. It is very deterministic at the quantum level. Opposites attract. Energy seeks equilibrium. Full stop. The only thing that creates the indeterminacy is the equilateral geometry. It gives an extra amount of complexity as to the chirality and the opposite charges for the same thing. So we go from a system at the quantum level that we can theoretically model everything in the universe and its outcomes if we had enough information about the particles where they are now and what energies is about, which is the old discussion back in Occam's time. If you have enough information about a system, you can determine its future and know what's going to happen to it. So if you could model every particle in the universe, I show that you can, in fact, predict what's going to happen to the universe, and we get rid of Heisenberg's uncertainty. But the intriguing part is, as we build up these chem fields and move to BEM fields, and we get to the humans and animals, we suddenly have what most people would call free will, a level of choice that can be affected by the chem and BEM fields, by the organic robots, if you like, that we've created in a deterministic mechanical fashion. We've created these robots, which are animals, us included, that suddenly can make choices and affect the outcome of the universe. Now, that was never there in a purely mechanical universe as it was originally designed. So we've started with a triangle that says we can build a universe and predict exactly what will happen with it. We get rid of Heisenberg's uncertainty, and we move to a universe which, at a particular level, which is where you specialize with your medical and your organic fields,
freedom of choice.
The organic versus the inorganic, we suddenly have this layer of choice, free will, and the ability to change the outcome that doesn't exist at the quantum level, which is quite the inverse of how it's perceived at the moment. At the moment, the physicists say we control our destinies, we know what's happening at the macro scale, but we don't know what's happening at the quantum scale. Well, Tetrionics turns that on its head. It shows that we can build precise models of all the atoms that they say is impossible. But what it also shows is that when we go from inorganic to organic, we introduce this choice mechanism, the ability to affect our own destiny and to change the predetermined results of a purely mechanical universe. And that's an interesting discussion all on its own. It really turns it upside down.
Calvin, this is wonderful. there's one thing about it. Every time we come up to a new connection, so we can all link it up. But I also think it would be practical to have a closure to this specific recording, which at the moment is getting close to exactly 120 minutes. So is it okay with you if we close it down and that I come back to you and then we can?
For sure.
Yeah. Great. Thank you.
No problems.
I'll just hang up and come back to you.
Okay.